Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Most kids these days can often be found glued to a phone or an iPad, watching their favorite shows, playing games, and connecting on Facebook or other social media. Parents use safety settings and other controls, but it is still hard to make sure your kids are safe when they're online. Parent Alert, How to Keep Your Kids Safe Online by Will Geddes and Nadia Sawala gives parents some simple strategies that can keep you informed about your kids' activities online. Geddes says he wanted to cut through the endless information online about internet safety and provide some meaningful information.
And I think one of the biggest challenges is, well, firstly, amazingly, when they told me, let's write this book, let's put it together, I was thinking, there must be lots of books like this out there already. But surprisingly, there aren't. And this is the first, most sort of conclusive and thorough go-to guide that has come out. And I think the biggest challenge for many parents has been that when they've heard a particular phrase or of a particular type of threat that their child could be exposed to online, or they saw a news story about it, they go online, they Google it, and they get so many results coming back that it's almost overwhelming. And then some of that information is also very contradictory. So that then only adds to that confusion. And I think for many parents, they just think, where can I go? What can I look at? Where is the best place to get advice? So as you may have seen in the book, I've tried to put this in a really pragmatic, sensible way that balances between the parents that are quite tech savvy themselves to those that really aren't tech savvy and are starting from almost a ground zero, if you like, in not knowing exactly where to start. And again, this has been one of the challenges for many parents because they grew up in a time where they just did not have this technology. And this has come about so quickly that they've been swamped by it.
I think one of the scariest things as a parent, from what I've seen with my own daughter online, is her connecting with people I don't know and she doesn't know, and that they don't realize how dangerous it is.
Absolutely. And I mean, statistically, 43% of children have spoken to a stranger online, and a vast majority of girls will talk to a stranger online and not even tell their parents about it. I mean, in fact, I think the figure is something like 86% of girls have had online chats that their parents don't know about.
Yeah, that's really frightening. How can we work with our kids to help them know what the danger signs are, what to do, and also if they feel, you know, they're being threatened or there's some kind of pornography they run into?
Well, yes. I mean, I think to cover your last point, if I might, as the first answer, the first thing I think, unfortunately, we have to kind of accept and acknowledge is that children will see entirely inappropriate content online, whether that be pornography or adult or explicit content of some nature, because unfortunately the filters aren't there to necessarily protect them. Even with parental controls in place, there is a chance that they may see it accidentally, or they may even see it on one of their friends' devices. So we have to accept that they will see content that we would rather that they didn't. But it really goes back to what I call the three T's, which is trusting, first and foremost. Now, the digital environment, the virtual world, is going to be integral to their lives. We know it is for us as adults, and you know, our entire lives are contained within our mobile devices, for example, that we'll keep in our back pocket. It has our social media, it has our banking, it has our address book, it has our communications. So we have to accept that they are going to need to interact with the virtual world regardless. So it's about establishing trust, and that's trust that goes both ways. As parents, I don't really condone spying, but I do certainly condone actually checking periodically and engaging, which takes us to the next T, which is talking with the child. And it's understanding that the child will have two worlds that they inhabit. There's their real world, which is where all their buddies from school, the friends in the neighborhood, the kids of other family friends that they will talk with, meet with, interact with. And then there's this virtual world, which is, as you say, all these people that they won't necessarily ever never meet, in some regards, we hope they never do, that they have to take at face value. But we need to teach them that actually they mustn't take them at face value, that people online aren't necessarily who they say they are. And that could be for various different reasons. And then lastly, it's teamwork. I think the time for a parent to simply take their hands off the steering wheel and leave it for the child to simply go on that adventure on their own, unescorted, I think is reckless, and I think it is also potentially endangering. So it's working as a team so that the child can feel they can come and talk to you about something without it being judgmental or being punished, that they can discuss and explore and help you explain maybe things that confuse them, things that upset them, and help navigate them through these uncharted waters.
I just wonder, because I see kids trying to emulate, especially other YouTube personalities, especially the women who do the sort of sexy things and talk about sexy things, and the kids want to get on there and have this, they want to have a channel, they want to do this kind of thing as well. Do you think there's an age that's appropriate for them to have a channel? I see them wanting to have one when they're 9 and 10 years old.
One of the things that I've put into the back of the book is actually a timeline for particular ages and the kind of online activity that I think is the kind of acceptable thresholds to do things. But for example, most social media, whether that be Facebook or Instagram, all generally have 13 years old as a minimum age. However, nearly a quarter of 8 to 11-year-old children will have a social media account. And in many of those instances, the parents are already aware of it. I think it's important to allow children to explore their personalities online, but I think within controlled parameters. And I had one parent who said to me, you know, my child has got 2 Instagram accounts, for example, and they were horrendously worried about it. And I turned around and said, actually, it's something that you don't necessarily need to be that worried about, because those 2 Instagram accounts could be one that's their personal and private one, which they have with their family, with their friends, and that they share their own social activities with. And then there's the public one, which is for their followers to garnish, obviously, some kind of online presence in whatever capacity. Now, as a parent, you should know what that is, so you can monitor it. If they put anything inappropriate on there, you can ideally take it off, but ideally advise them not to in the first place. But the privacy settings on any social media account are critical to understand, not only for the child, but for you as a parent, so you can ensure that that private account remains private and only seen by the people that you choose.
That was Will Geddes, one of the authors of Parent Alert, How to Keep Your Kids Safe Online. Geddes and co-author Nadia Sawala wrote the book to cut to the chase about online safety tools for parents to use with their children. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Parents of talented and gifted children often use extracurricular activities and summer camps to give the kids some stimulating experiences they can't get in school. One of those camps is now in Sioux City, based at Morningside College this month. The Catalyst Collective gives middle and high school students a chance to stretch their right and left brains with STEM-based courses mixed with theater, music, and dance. Heath Weber is with the Catalyst Collective, and he's also the Associate Dean for Performing Arts at Morningside College. Weber says the camp is a place where kids can try new things and explore different sides to their personalities without the fear of failing.
Failure is not the ending point. Failure becomes a catalyst, to use our term, for continued growth until you find the answer. And I think more than anything, what we do at camp is give young people an opportunity to try new things. And if they fail in the setting, it's okay. We want them to try lyrical dance. We want them to try singing. We want them to try an academic subject that is completely foreign. We want them to attempt leadership capabilities that they didn't think were in them. And And if it doesn't go the right way, that they know that there's a next time, another time, and that it doesn't mean the end. So often in the life of a gifted youth, they think that that failure is the end. So they fail at something and then they stop because they immediately say, well, I'm not good at it. I'm done. I'm not doing it. That's not the answer for a young, bright student. The answer is, all right, let's dig in and find the path out. So I think what we do really well at the Catalyst Collective is giving students the capacity to find the path out, as opposed to letting the failure stop the student. We allow the failure to say, all right, what other branches exist from that point? How can I find a new way around what I learned didn't go well? More than anything, our staff and the students work to support that in every level, academically, artistically, and social, emotionally. It's a powerful vehicle to encourage self-actualization. I think that's probably the best way to put what we do, is a powerful vehicle for self-actualization.
I like how you have the, you know, your typical courses and type of areas where you'd expect to have things for talented and gifted students, or the math or science, but you have the other side of it too, the creative side, the music, the dance. And I think there's something must happen that's really amazing when those two things come together.
It is true. You know, we've worked over many, many years to really fine tune what we do. And I think if you talk to any business person, if you talk to any entrepreneur, any inventor, what they'll tell you is they want employees who are malleable and creative and innovative. And the way to achieve that within young people is to teach it. You have to teach the creative process. And that comes through the arts. It comes through learning about things that you don't know, you aren't comfortable with, and finding out how to make them work. And I think getting up on stage to sing or to dance or to act or to make people laugh gives a sense of accomplishment that you can't achieve by getting a perfect score on a paper or doing really well on the ACT. That's great, and those are markers of excellent knowledge. But unabashed and unparalleled applause at the end of a really great performance does something to you that says, yes, you did this well, and you can do it again. And I think that piece, that creative piece and that performance piece, coupled with a passion for learning, makes these young people capable to really fine-tune learning and deepen their learning and engage in a different way in this kind of setting.
And how to work together with other people and share friendship and laughs and just be also a kid.
Absolutely. You know, we forget about that, right? We forget so often that kids need to be kids. Kids need to, and they need to have people like them, right? We as adults, we gravitate around people who are like us and people who have similar interests. And if you are a kid in small town South Dakota or small town Iowa, and you're the only one that thinks like this, you're the only one who likes to read Ayn Rand, or you're the only one who really loves rocketry, and then all of a sudden you come to this camp and you found someone who does those same things, well, my goodness, you found a friend for life, and you found someone that you can share those ideas with. And all of a sudden you're laughing about the same things, and you've built a lifelong friend. And there is power in friendship that transcends time and place. And this place builds those friendships. I was talking to staff members that the speaker that we had in was a camper when I was a camper, and our friendship has transcended almost 30 years of of time. And we ended up in many different places. She's worked all over the world with CEOs and execs. And I've worked all over the Midwest as a choral director and as a creative person. And oddly enough, we intersect in Sioux Falls and reconnect. And all of a sudden, she's able to chat with students and inspire my camp students. And it's really so powerful. The camaraderie and the like-mindedness is, you know, I think the thing that is most important for young people is that it really doesn't matter if you are a wildly talented singer, dancer, actor, mathematician, writer, thinker. You are welcome to develop those talents and gifts at this camp. And you might find a aspect of giftedness that you never knew was there. You know, you might find a pathway that leads to engineering or even agricultural work through drone work. You know, Rich Crow taught a drone class today, and students got an opportunity to see how they can be used, not just to take cool pictures high up above, but to work in a field, or perhaps they might decide that they want to work in real estate and use that to highlight a beautiful home or work to develop a cool ad campaign. And so all of a sudden, this mind who was saying, well, gosh, I think that I was going to do this one thing, all of a sudden, that one course might open up a whole new field. And what it becomes is exactly what I spoke about earlier. It gives young people a capacity to find new ways out of what they thought needed to happen. And I think more than anything, we stress the importance of following those little tributaries off of that main route. Find the way to create your own you. And find the energy and excitement of innovation and creativity and artistic potential and academic potential, and just make that work for you. I'm just really proud of the young people we have. I'm really proud of the staff. It's a great opportunity to learn and grow.
That was Heath Weber with the Catalyst Collective Camp for Talented and Gifted Students. It's going on this and next week at Morningside College. Weber is also the Associate Dean of Performing Arts at Morningside College. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. This Saturday, the group Unity in the Community is hosting a community connection between citizens and law enforcement at Dale Street Park. It's a chance to engage and learn from each other. Monique Scarlett of Unity in the Community says the goal of the event is to get into the heart of the neighborhood.
Bring law enforcement in there in the more friendly atmosphere where some have on uniforms, some don't, and citizen engagement takes place. We have everyone from children to our senior adults having those conversations. Just a great way of bonding and getting to know each other as a community.
And how many people do you usually have coming to these?
Last year, it was phenomenal. We counted over 1,000 tickets that we had given away, because you get a ticket to come in for all of the free giveaways. And we had handed out a little over 1,000 tickets last year. And so it was packed. It was just a great turnout. Everyone had a lot of fun. So we're looking for about that same amount this year in preparation.
Do people end up leaving with sort of a better feeling about the police and other people in charge and of public safety in the city?
People leave with a fully engaged perspective. There's much more appreciation for our law enforcement, and also our law enforcement has a better understanding of how the community views law enforcement because of things that are happening on a nationwide scale. That's why we're proactive with these type of block parties and events with Unity in the Community to make sure we stay ahead of the game and have our officers and our citizens fully engaged. So when they leave with appreciation and respect for each other.
Do you have any other events planned this summer?
For Unity in the Community, we hold two annual events. The one is the block party for the fun atmosphere. And then the other one, we always want that educational piece. And so we hold a public forum every year in October at the Sioux City Public Museum. Unity in the Community has the community connection. And for our mission for Unity in the Community, it's keeping peace, hope, love, and prayer in the lives of our community, which will embrace the partnerships and support of citizens and law enforcement at all times. So we have the fun block party. We have the educational awareness in October. But we work year around within our public schools, and we attend nonprofit organizations, and we do a little mini workshop or presentations to enlighten them and to have that roundtable discussion.
If someone is interested in attending the event on Saturday, do they need to register before? They can just come?
They can just show up. Again, it's a free event. No cash needed at all. It's a fun atmosphere for children and adults of all ages. You'll come, you'll get a ticket in your hand. Hold on to that ticket to claim your free prize that we've been giving away throughout the day. We start at 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. And food is provided, games are provided, there's going to be music of all kinds, and it's just going to be a huge, great celebrating of Unity.
That was Monique Scarlett of Unity in the Community, talking about this Saturday's community connection at Dale Street Park from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. The event is free and open to the public. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. This Wednesday afternoon, the Disabilities Resource Center of Siouxland held a disability forum for state and local political candidates at the Siouxland Center for Active Generations. 12 candidates showed up, including those for governor, Iowa legislative seats, congressional seats, and local offices. Don Du, the executive director of the Resource Center, moderated the forum. Around 75 people showed up to hear from the candidates. Many of them were concerned about the way privatized Medicaid is working. Many of the attendees had disabilities and were having problems accessing services. Sioux City State Representative Chris Hall was attending the forum as a surrogate for Democratic candidate for Governor Fred Hubbell. Hall said the privatization of Medicaid has been one of the most disastrous policy changes at the state level that has happened in decades.
The privatization of Medicaid has created an incentive to for-profit companies to provide less health care to disabled and vulnerable individuals and instead take those dollars as a profit. We have heard and read numerous stories across the state of individuals who have had critical services denied to them. We have small businesses that have been put out of business, and some of them here in Sioux City, because of the privatization and poor reimbursement policies of these for-profit companies. And right now, Governor Reynolds' administration is hiding from the public the dollars and budgetary agreement with a third company that is coming into the state to provide treatment.
Susan Stewart, who is the chair of the Woodbury County Republican Party, served as a surrogate for Governor Reynolds. Stewart read a statement, and here's what she said.
Thank you. I'll be very brief, just like everyone else has today. Governor Reynolds asked me to attend the forum, as well as all the Republican candidates who represent Woodbury County, and take notes and get your concerns back to them. Governor Reynolds thanks the Disability Resource Center for putting this forum together. She's not aware that there are many others like this throughout the state. She believes helping Iowans with disabilities is paramount, and she points out to some of the services and legislation that have been passed recently. She would point to Iowa Workforce Development as a resource that's committed to serving Iowans with disabilities, the Medicaid program, and the money that was invested in healthcare and the programs for healthcare that were enacted in the past 2 years.
There is more talk about privatized Medicaid and also about the transfer of Woodbury County from Sioux Rivers Mental Health and Disability Services Group to the Rolling Hills Group. County Supervisor Jeremy Taylor said the new agreement with Rolling Hills is financially advantageous for Woodbury County.
If you want long-term stability and funding for services, Rolling Hills, the new region that we are entering into, will be approximately $4.2 million of spending authority. 4.2, folks. Contrast that with a $3.1 million in Sioux and Plymouth and Woodbury and Sioux Rivers.
However, Flora Lee, who's running against Taylor in this fall's election for the Board of Supervisors, said she wasn't sure that Woodbury County has been a good partner in the Sioux Rivers group.
The county did not take enough time, if there was not transparency for Woodbury County, to educate people in Plymouth and Sioux as to what transparency really looks like on their behalf. And I don't think we worked really hard to really partner with these folks and collaborate and combine ideas and to understand the culture of Sioux and Plymouth County, as well as them understanding the culture of Woodbury County. And I think we've moved out of that because of some of those factors that may not necessarily be financial, but personal. That's my opinion, and I'm going to stick with it. But I do want you to be very clear that we're going to have to put $1 million in a cash reserve. That's what I'm calling it. You may call it something else. But is that going to raise the levy for Woodbury County? Yes, it is.
Carter Smith is also running for the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors against Matthew Ung, who couldn't make it to the forum. Smith, who works as an HIV caseworker at Siouxland Community Health Center, said he wanted to run for office in part because he was concerned that leadership issues could be impacting the delivery of services.
With our relationship with Sioux Rivers, there were definitely some things on both sides that leadership-wise could have probably been resolved. As we move forward into the future, there's a lot of things at the state level that are going to impact what we do with this state wanting to establish access points and not knowing how that will look down the road. Our transition into Rolling Hills is something that could probably be impacted by that, from what I understand. I was also aware of the memo from Don Metzner about services subject to termination, and I would be concerned that if we're getting a letter from their CEO stating that services are subject to termination because they're outside their non-core services, wanting to make sure that our people that are on the board are advocating for those programs and why they benefit our local constituents.
Candidates also talked at length about the many problems that people with disabilities have in doing basic things like voting. Don Dew said thousands of Woodbury County residents have some kind of disability, and many aren't registered to vote. Sioux City Democratic State House Representative Tim Cassina blamed the Republicans' new voter ID law, calling it voter suppression.
We took away the amount of time they have to vote. We made it harder for the areas where they have trouble voting, such as your disability, your lower income people. These are put up purposely to hold the vote down, and that's just the opposite of what we should be doing.
Democratic 6th District House candidate Rita DeYoung said the state needs to do a better job in helping people get to the polls and vote.
We obviously have not, we're not really looking to get the people that need or have the right to vote. What we're doing is putting a barrier in front of them by having this new law and this new setup. We need to educate the people that are actually running the election polling places to make sure that they're very welcomed.
Former State Representative Dave Dawson from Woodbury County also attended the forum. The Democrat is running against incumbent Jim Carlin for the Iowa State Senate District 3 this fall. Dawson said he has a history of trying to make voting more accessible.
When I was in the Iowa House, I sponsored legislation and introduced legislation that anybody who got a driver's license in Iowa was automatically registered to vote. And I also support legislation that would have everybody vote by mail automatically, which is a law that they have in the state of Oregon, so that your ballot will be mailed to you at least a month in advance of the election, give you time to research the candidates at home. If you need assistance, give someone else the opportunity to help you fill out your ballot and return it in time for the election so that every vote can be counted and that as many people as possible can participate. And I think that would help a lot of people who have disabilities because right now the process is you have to sign up to request an absentee ballot to be mailed to you every election. But if it was mailed out automatically, if you as a registered voter got that opportunity to vote without barrier, if it's coming directly to your home, I think more people would be allowed to vote.
At the end of the forum, Don Dew thanked everyone for attending and mentioned that there is another forum coming up. The Resource Center is one of several organizations hosting an event in recognition of the 28th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. That's on August 1st at the Sioux City Public Museum. It's free and open to the public. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Every summer weekend in Siouxland, you can find families driving north to the Iowa Great Lakes. However, Lake Okoboji is not just for weekends anymore. New research shows that Dickinson County is increasingly a year-round place to call home. Over the past 7 years, many small towns have been shrinking, but Dickinson County was the 11th fastest growing community in the state. The Sioux City Journal reports it posted 3.17% growth from 2010 to 2017. Kylie Miller is the president and CEO of the Iowa Lakes Corridor Development Corporation, the regional economic development agency for Buena Vista, Clay, Dickinson, and Emmett counties. Miller says the growth in the Iowa Great Lakes area is emblematic of the job growth in this state and the need for housing.
Well, across the state of Iowa, we have a job opportunities in multiple industries. The Iowa Lakes Corridor, where I work, is no exception. In Dickinson County, certainly that's the case. In Dickinson County, you have the tourism industry, which is an obvious jobs driver, but as well, there's a large manufacturing base there. There is a great ag sector. And because of the presence of the lakes, one of the things that's most exciting is the entrepreneurial community that is in the area. And with those entrepreneurs, that creates new business opportunities and new job opportunities for talented professionals.
So basically, when we look at the extra housing, are we talking about, you know, single-family homes? Are we talking about also apartments and condos?
That's correct, ma'am. There's certainly single-family construction. The most prevalent growth in that area has been in Spirit Lake. But Arnold's Park and Milford have also experienced strong single-family construction. But as well, there's been a new apartment complex opened in Spirit Lake last year. There's been apartment construction. And, of course, Okoboji accommodates a great many condos.
Yeah, I was reading in the article over the weekend that Dickinson County scored among the top 10 in Iowa for net migration gains over the past 7 years, which is pretty significant considering, you know, there's so many stories about people moving out of Iowa, moving out especially of smaller towns and cities.
Well, that's true. Across rural Iowa, I believe 69 of Iowa's 99 counties lost population in the last 5 years. A big driver of that, of course, is outward migration as our population consolidates in urban or metropolitan areas, Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, and even out of state. Dickinson County, on the other hand, has enjoyed that strong inward migration that you referred to. And I really believe that's a function of a great quality of life and also a known brand. Across the state of Iowa, people know about Okoboji. They know about Dickinson County. They've heard of these places, and they recognize them as a great place to be.
Do you get a lot of what we call empty nesters up there, or seniors?
Oh, certainly we do. Certainly we do. Early retirees, empty nesters, choosing to advance in their life in a new location, a place that they've always dreamed of living.
Your group has been talking about the lake life. That's part of your marketing campaign. What exactly is lake life? How do you describe it?
Sure. And our brand is getalakeslife.com. And we invite anybody to visit getalakeslife.com to learn about job opportunities, business acquisition opportunities, and quality of life. But really the message that we're saying is, why wait until for 2 weeks of a year to go on vacation? Why not have your vacation start at 5 p.m. every day? And that's really what a great environment like Okoboji and the Iowa Great Lakes generally offers is you go to work, it's 5 p.m., it's time to get off work, and even if it's as simple as taking your bike along West Lake and gazing out at the boats, that is still a wonderful, therapeutic, and beneficial lifestyle that this area offers. So when we say get a lakes life, what we're really talking about is to enjoy your vacation every day.
But really, the surge in population isn't just in Dickinson County, right?
Across rural Iowa, there are a great many opportunities for talented people to advance their careers. That's in part, sadly, because many areas are losing population and they are aging. So a lot of businesses and a lot of organizations in, for instance, utilities, schools, hospitals and stuff, have a real need for talent. This Iowa is today a great place to accelerate your career. And we just invite people from across the Midwest and even across the country to experience what's going on in our area.
What do you think it is about the economy now? And as you say, it might be the fact that we're really looking for workers. We're trying to get people to come here and work. We need talented and trained workers. But it does, that up there, the Iowa Great Lakes have been a prime spot for vacationers around the area for more than 100 years. And it just seems like now it's come to the point where it's more than that.
Well, if you're asking about the macroeconomic environment, I think we can all agree that right now our nation's enjoying a period of strong growth. And certainly we benefit from that. Our economy is simply a microcosm of the larger macrocosm of the U.S. economy. That being said, as well, there has been a long time, for many years, a strong manufacturing base in Dickinson County. It just sort of was not noticed amid the brand that is tourism in that particular area. But now, as we see the need for jobs across the economy, I think more people are becoming aware that it really is a more diversified location than maybe they perceived.
It also seems like a wonderful place if you're an environmentalist, if you're interested in learning about the natural world. I think it's really become Dickinson County a real haven for that.
I would agree with that, and I would go a little bit further and point out that Dickinson County has, I believe, and the most acres of public recreation ground in the state. And when you add on to it all that Clay County, Emmett County, Buena Vista County has to offer, there's just a great opportunity to get outside up here in Northwest Iowa. I'm from Southeast Iowa. I love that area, but I'll admit there's almost no public hunting ground, for instance, whereas Here in the lakes of northwest Iowa, I have thousands of acres that I can take my dog running and go look for pheasants if I want.
That was Kylie Miller, the president and CEO of the Iowa Lakes Corridor Development Corporation, the regional economic development agency for Buena Vista, Clay, Dickinson, and Emmett counties. Miller was talking about the robust growth in housing and the increase in year-round residents in the Iowa Great Lakes area.
Okoboji Day. The tiki lights at Brocco's are setting the mood. I got my girl beside me and we're feeling good. Climbing the boat, we're headed on back. A bottle of wine and a favorite snack. We sure had ourselves at Okoboji.
And that was Hey, It's an Okoboji Day by Michael Hope. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. It's the motto of the United States. So how does that get applied to art? Our arts producer, Ellie Carson, talks to curator Todd Behrens about a new exhibition at the Sioux City Arts Center that's been pulled together from the permanent collection.
The idea in terms of art is that you're looking at an individual artwork, which is the result of many different components. And in the case of the artworks we've selected for this exhibition, what you'll find is a use of repeated lines, forms, shapes, colors, textures, sometimes to create a pattern, sometimes in a more random way, but used by the artist for a specific purpose to guide your eyes, make you think about something differently, make you see something a little differently. But how the artist used these multiple components to create something uniform.
Yeah, and these are all pieces that you're selecting from the permanent collection.
From the permanent collection, that's correct. Some of them have not been seen before. We've specifically targeted a number of our larger pieces, so that's always kind of fun to see something really big. I don't know, it's more of a wow experience, but we also have some smaller pieces that haven't been seen in a long time.
And what kind of thread are you pulling through these paintings, or is it really just about the composition?
Yeah, we do certainly many exhibitions that have a particular theme or subject that's being explored either by one artist, by a number of artists. In this case, there is no common idea or theme. It's simply looking at the way in which artists construct images. And it's always been part of art, but it's really, in many ways, in the history of art, a relatively new idea, maybe 120 years, which is relatively new for thousands of years of art production, of thinking about your painting, if you're doing a painting, not simply as a picture of what you're looking at, but as each mark, each line, each color and shape that you're adding is a construction. And how are you planning things out to make certain that the construction, regardless of subject or theme or narrative, works visually. And it's, like I said, it's only been in the last 120 years or so that has been the way in which artists are usually taught and how they often work. Not every artist works mm-hmm. that way, of course, but, the interesting thing about this, and it might be harder to understand than in, say, music or either poetry or literature, is it's basically a guideline, a set of, framework for people to work in. So it's the same in poetry. Language has rules. It's the same in music, where rhythm and tempo and harmony, those things apply absolutely to art as well. So it's one of those things that's a part of our lives, whether we know it or not. And so it's kind of taking a look at what's behind the artwork.
Mm-hmm. And giving us a look behind the scenes of what you keep in the permanent collection.
That's true. So this show, and we'll be opening up another show in mid-August, also from the permanent collection. In part, we're doing that to explore some educational principles with art, but we're also using the opportunity for the construction that we're going through, both with the Learning Center and in the months to come within the Art Center itself, that will disrupt in a way our ability to store art. So a lot of the art that we usually store has to come out on the walls so that we can proceed with our construction.
To me, there's this air of mystery around the permanent collection. You're talking about, like an art vault, and it all sounds very mysterious.
It is. I know. We're very typical of other museums, whether it's art museums or other forms of museums, where we collect to make sure that we retain some form of ties to our history. But our ability to display absolutely everything is always going to be limited.
How many pieces are in the permanent collection? Ballpark?
Ballpark, 1,100 to 1,200.
Okay. And about how many will be in E Pluribus Unum?
Oh, only about 25 or so. If I picked smaller works, I could probably fit in maybe 40 or 50, but we've got some, as I said, some big pieces.
Todd Behrens is the curator at the Sioux City Art Center. E Pluribus Unum opens this Saturday. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Allie Carson.
And that's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.